Hello and welcome to series 3 of Out with Susie Ruffle with me, Susie Ruffle. Hello. I'm very excited that the podcast is back. We've got a whole new series, some fantastic guests lined up, and I'm very excited to share it all with you. I hope that you're doing okay. I mean, it's hard to believe when still in another state of lockdown when we started this podcast back in March last year. And we were in lockdown one, I definitely didn't think that when we were going into the third series, we'd still be living in such an unusual way, but here we are. And I hope that you're coping with it okay. I am still going on a lot of walks. I might be bored of walking, but I'm lucky to have some green space around me, I know that. Thanks to everyone that's been in touch in the series break and at the end of the last series. It seemed that loads and loads of you really enjoy the show, and I'm so delighted. I'm so delighted, and I'm so proud of this little show, and that people within the community and our allies are enjoying it so much. So thank you. If you do want to rate and review, I know that every podcast says this, I know it's so dull, but if you rate and review, it does really help people find it, which is really useful to us here at Out. Please tweet and Instagram, it's always super helpful, and if you have, I appreciate that so much. And thank you to so many of you that have got in touch. We get so many emails, and honestly I read every single one of them, and I really appreciate people getting in touch and people reaching out and sharing their stories with me. And before we get on with today's episode, which is a brilliant conversation with Rose and Rosie, very famous, very brilliant British YouTubers, let's share some emails. Now, before we begin, I also want to say something. Loads of you have got in touch with some brilliant guest suggestions. And I want you to know that I've reached out to loads of the people you've suggested. I've reached out to loads of people within the sports world. Some people have been in touch about wanting to get another trans guy's perspective. I've reached out to some trans guys. I'm hoping that they'll get back to me. Obviously, with this podcast, all I can do is reach out and ask for people to be on it. So I'm sorry if the people that you've suggested haven't come up. That's often because maybe they don't have time, maybe they will in the future. But I really appreciate getting your suggestions, and I always take them really seriously, and I very often reach out. But I don't know everyone. Do you know someone that you think I should interview? If you do, let me know. Okay, let's get on with some listener emails. Dear Susie, I hope you're well. I wanted to get in touch and say thank you to you and the team at Keep It Like Media for the podcast. My wife and I recently moved from the UK to live in a very remote house up a mountain in Portugal. So in a way, I've gone from one form of isolation to another, and during this time, your podcast has been such a comfort and joy. I'm trying to ration the episodes, but so far I've loved them all, and I'm really looking forward to series 3. There's something so quietly reassuring in hearing stories of your guests and picking out similarities and differences in their coming out stories and my own. I grew up in the 90s in a very working class area in Newcastle, and learned quickly that being gay was synonymous with being bad or wrong. I have a very vivid memory of playing with a group of kids who lived on my street. We were playing with a football, and an old lady drove over the ball we'd been kicking about, and it burst. As her car turned the corner, I loudly tutted at the driver and exclaimed, "Lesbian." One of the older boys turned to me and shouted, "That's my Nana, and she's not a lesbian, you are." He was right, but being only a child at the time, it would take me another decade to learn and understand the meaning of the word. And though the true definition was lost on me, at 6 years old, I already knew that being a lesbian was a very powerful and very bad thing to be. I went through primary school being completely disinterested in boys, but kissing them anyway, as it seemed to be the thing to do. It wasn't until secondary school, when I developed feelings for my, surprise, surprise, PE teacher, that I realised something was not right. I felt confused and was certain I was the only person in the world with these kind of unusual feelings. My school was an all-girls school and was previously a convent school. The grounds were littered with rows of graves belonging to nuns who used to run the school, and I was certain I would soon join them, because if anyone found out my secret, I was sure to die of shame. I would find out years later that my school was wall-to-wall lesbians, and we were all stewing in our own hell, pretending to like the boys and learning how to do a slamming French plait as a kind of cloaking device for our gayness. I can joke about it now, but I hit my sexuality at 18 when I was very gay, very self-assured. A friend told me that I should just get over it and come out, and that everything would be fine. High on the optimism of youth and 6 episodes of The L Word, I went home feeling that coming out surely couldn't be as painful as hiding who I truly was and the threat of a loveless future. I decided to come out to my mum first, and wanting to get it over and done with, I blurted it out that I had something to tell her. Then, unable to say what it was, I made her guess. She asked if I was pregnant, and when I shook my head, we both knew that it was almost unnecessary to ask the same question. We were certain what was next on the list. I started to cry, and it confirmed that she already knew I was gay. I curled up into a ball because I couldn't bear to look at her. She was so shocked and paled and didn't say anything. I asked her through tears, "Do you still love me?" "Of course," she replied, and gave me a big cuddle. I made her promise not to tell my dad, not just yet. I needed a couple of days to figure out what I wanted to say. The time came and I sat down in front of the telly, ready to tell my dad that I was gay, when I found out my mum had already gotten there first. I opened up by saying that I had something to tell him. "So is it true?" he said. I nodded and looked at my feet. I thought he'd be angry and was preparing to grab my bag and some clothes before being thrown out. The expected tirade didn't come. I looked up to see him with his head in his hands, sobbing. I'd never seen my dad cry. He'd lost his father to cancer and his sister to an unexpected heart attack a few years prior, but despite this, I had never seen him shed a tear until now. I had broken my dad. He recovered enough to wipe his tears, apologise for crying, and give me a big hug. He explained to me that he was only upset because he'd spent years imagining my life with a career, a loving family and children, and it never occurred to him there could be an alternative life plan. "But," he said, "I suppose you could have all those things with a woman, couldn't you?" He was right, but the damage was done. I was mortified at having upset my family so much, and my shame increased tenfold. I resolved to go back into the closet to a life of loveless, unfulfilling relationships with men. I ended up in a relationship with a guy I'd kissed at primary school all those years before. He was caring and safe, and for a while the relationship worked, but I was racked with self-doubt and insecurity. And after a year, things began to fall apart. The relationship ended. He dumped me and I flew into sheer panic, trying desperately to convince him we should get back together. I cried, I pleaded, but there was no going back. It took me years to realise that the end of this relationship had stoked so much fear and panic because it meant that I would have to stop hiding and start facing the truth about my sexuality. I struggled with feeling abandoned, I lost weight and had some very dark thoughts. But after years of not knowing what I wanted to do with my life, I enrolled in a fine art course and life at university was a welcome distraction to the sadness and shame I still wasn't ready to consider. I struggled through my first year at uni and slowly began to feel more open and accepting of myself. I had a few brief and heady flings with women, but it wasn't until my mid-20s when I met a woman I would go on to marry that I finally found the peace within myself to come out again at 24. I met my wife at an art gallery we both worked at, and within hours of meeting her, I knew she was a woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. She was already in a long-term relationship when we first met, but I was patient and I was there as a shoulder to cry on when the relationship came to an end 6 months later. We started dating and it felt so pure and right that my joy was simply uncontainable. I knew that I was going to have to come out again. I'd spent the last 5 years pretending to be straight and my relationship with my family was fairly stable. We talked about mundane, trivial things and watched telly in silence. We didn't talk about the time I tried to come out as gay. It had clearly just been a phase. But now I was happy. I was in this amazing relationship with a woman, and although I didn't want to deny my sexuality and hide my true feelings from myself, my family was another matter. I couldn't help thinking about all the sadness and upset I'd caused the first time round. So I distanced myself from everyone. Even though I lived fairly close to my parents, I stopped visiting them almost entirely. My Nana, who was a huge part of my life and the person I was worried most about telling my secret to, started seeing less and less of me. After a few months of absence, my family were really concerned. On one of the rare visits to my parents' house, my mum confronted me to ask if there was anything wrong. Tired of hiding and feeling like a liar, I decided I couldn't keep it to myself anymore. I told her I was in a relationship and she probably wouldn't like it because my partner was a woman. My mum became still and quiet. It was different quiet than before. She seemed calm and unfazed. Smiling, she took my hand and said that she just wanted me to be happy. I wasn't sure how to feel. The news trickled through the family. This time when it got round to my dad, he was completely fine with the news. Truth be told, he just wanted to be left alone to watch the football. My sister called me one day to say, "Jade, you're gay. I mean this in the nicest possible way. I really don't care." I just had to laugh. We chatted on the phone for a while before she told me. "Nana knows. Do you know what she said, Jade? She said out of all of her grandkids, she loves you the most because you need it most." I cried. It was mainly tears of joy, relief and acceptance, but also a slow realisation that of everyone in my family, no one could have been harder on me than I had been to myself. In 2017, I was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and I can't help but think that this only compounded my feelings of an otherness that were already present because of my sexuality. I spent the last few years learning to accept this newly revealed part of myself. And I now realise that there are so many elements of our lives, both internal and external, that we can't control. Sometimes there are things in life that are already decided for you. Sometimes you get to be the decision maker. I've decided to give myself every opportunity to be happy with who I am. Thanks for taking the time to read what has turned out to be a very long email. I'm looking forward to the next series of the podcast. I think I can speak for all of your listeners when I say it means more to us than you could ever know. Lots of love, Jade. Ah, you said you don't mind me mentioning your name, so thanks for that. Jade, I loved that email. I absolutely loved it. And I mean, you also have a lovely turn of phrase. There were moments that really made me laugh. But thanks so much for sharing that. I think it really shows how we can be hardest on ourselves. And it's so lovely to hear that about your nana. My nan, who I lost a few years ago now, had a very similar reaction to me coming out. She didn't say that I was her favourite, in case any of my cousins are listening, but she didn't care, I guess. She didn't care. And she did say how much she loved me, and it meant more to me than anyone will ever know. So thank you, Jade, for sharing your story. And I hope wherever you are up that mountain in Portugal, you're having an okay time in lockdown. Okay, let's have another one. Hi there, Susie. I know season 2 of the pod has just finished, but I decided to drop you an email anyhow. I wanted to say thank you so much for giving me a sense of community at the end of 2020. I came a little late to the pod at the start of December, and it's been really helpful and a bit of a relief at the end of a difficult year. I am non-binary, queer, and neurodivergent. Like many other queer and trans people, I feel I've spent my entire life coming out in one way or another. Firstly, going down the route of my sexuality, and then finally embracing different shades of grey within my gender. Sadly, I don't have many queer local friends. I'm in a unique position that my alphabet mafia chosen family, my LGBTQIA plus friends, are all abroad. It was a happy accident that I found them. And while we keep in touch with daily group messages, it's not been the same with the pandemic, as I have done the responsible thing and grounded myself from all travelling. I've spent the majority of the last 9 months indoors with my cat, Gypsy Danger. And while I have a lot of eclectic interests, I have become starved for queer company. Just how starved I was wasn't something I was fully aware of until I began listening to your podcast and felt my shoulders drop a little and the tightness in my chest ease. Even though I'm 31 now and I've been out of the closet for 16 years, I sometimes forget that there's nothing as validating as having your identity and story reflected back at you by someone else. The podcast has been incredibly valuable to me, and I'm sure many others in a similar position. Thank you so much for reminding me there's enough space for everyone to coexist, and that queer identities, no matter how much or little they disrupt the expected norm, are valid. Thanks again, and I look forward to seeing you in series 3. All the best, Leo. In the unlikely event that you read this on the pod, you may use my name. It wasn't unlikely at all. I read it, Leo. Thank you so much for getting in touch, and I'm so pleased that this podcast has been a little part of community for you. And I'll be honest with you all, it's been that for me too. I'm the person that's lucky enough that gets to make it. But having all these interviews and sharing your stories and receiving emails it's been a huge benefit to me and my mental health and to my sense of community and who I am this year. Well, last year and this year now, isn't it? So thank you. Thank you to everyone that gets in touch. As I said before, your emails really do mean a lot to me. Okay. Let's have today's chat. I'm very excited for this one. We had a real laugh recording this, and there's lots of funny bits and lots of important messages too. And so I'm really excited to share it with you. Here is my chat with the brilliant Rose and Rosie. Rose and Rosie are brilliant British YouTubers. They are also married. They release weekly entertainment videos and they have nearly a million subscribers. They are funny, endearing, and never afraid of oversharing, which for someone as nosy as me is brilliant. They have hundreds of thousands of fans across the globe. They've released a book, a documentary, and they have their own podcast, Rose and Rosie Parental Guidance, about their journey to parenthood. They even shared their beautiful wedding with the world, which has been watched 2.3 million times. Put frankly, they're a massive deal. I met them on a rooftop in New York at World Pride, which is easily the coolest sentence I have ever said. What a joy it is to have them on the podcast today. Welcome to the show, Rose and Rosie.
Wow.
What an intro.
Wow.
Possibly the best one we've ever had.
No, the best one we've ever had. I feel wonderful.
Oh, that's good. Good. I'm pleased. Well, I only have people on the podcast that I actually genuinely want on there.
Oh, that's nice.
When people get in touch and say, can I do it? The answer is usually, I haven't reached out, and so I'm just going to ignore this because it's quite awkward. But we did meet on a rooftop, which is pretty cool.
It's really cool. It's really cool. It makes me feel very young, you know, very young. And I could do with that lately, honestly. So I'm looking for it.
I was with Tom Allen and I said, oh, there's Rose and Rosie. And he said, who are they? And I said, they are very famous lesbians. Or, although I know, no, I don't know. I think one of you identifies as bisexual, so I'd be very careful there to not put anyone in any boxes they don't want to be in. I mean, you are enormously successful.
Oh wow! Seriously, you are
a stand-up comedian who's on TV.
Yeah, that's not something we do. So I think you're successful.
Guys, I'm a massive deal.
Yeah,
do you know what? That's great. I'm really delighted with how this interview's gone.
I think that's the distinction.
I think that's ridiculous because I don't want to get into the YouTube stuff immediately because obviously I also you will notice I gesticulate a lot whilst I'm interviewing someone. It's sort of like I'm conducting a very small orchestra behind your heads, which I am. I want to get into the YouTube stuff and the fact that I feel like I know you, which I said is like we have met each other and I've actually been on your podcast, but yes. I do feel like I know you because of listening to your podcast. So I now have this strange sort of I fear that I'm going to be too pally. Oh, as the interview goes on,
you can never be too pally.
That's what I think. I think that's something that we try to carry through our entire lives. You can never be too pally with people until you do, and it gets weird though.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I don't want you to get off this call and be like, "Fucking hell, Ruffles a bit much, isn't she?"
No, we've already been there. We've said it. We've moved on. So
yeah. we've already bitched about you like so much. That's fine. So yeah.
Now, I'm very aware that there'll be listeners to this that know sort of everything about you because you have quite loyal fans.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fair to say. And also, though, it's not just that. I think because, you know, we started online talking about everything. I think there's not much more to say. Well, there's always more to say, but I feel like...
Yeah,
we've got no secrets.
So I may cover stuff that has been covered previously in your YouTube journey. But first of all, I want to start with, and I've already said I've never interviewed two people at the same time before, so watch me spinning these plates, guys. So where did you both grow up? Presuming you didn't sort of get birthed somewhere together and become best friends and then grow up into lovers. Which is sort of how it feels.
So I grew up in Ross-on-Wye, which is a tiny, tiny little town, quite close to the Welsh border.
Ross-on-Wye, would anyone live there?
Rosie,
you know what I mean?
She loves that joke. She loves it. So I grew up there. Nothing was happening. It's very boring, very small town vibes. And Rosie grew up in Malvern, which is only about 40 minutes sort of north of
another
there.
Small town, but not quite as small as Ross-on-Wye. You know, Malvern had things.
Yeah.
Like, I think Rose said to me that when she went to college in Ross-on-Wye, there was like... you know, one vending machine.
Yes.
And you came to my uni.
There was like
you were like,
cafeteria.
Wow, there's several vending machines.
Wow. Yeah. You're living the life. You're like a city girl. Yeah. So we weren't actually very far from each other. We just didn't know each other until we met through I'm going to call her a mutual friend.
We
kind of dated the same girl.
Yeah. And Rose had a serious relationship with her and I.
Classic.
A non-serious relationship.
Seriously disappointing relationship.
She was the bridge. Yeah. She was the bridge between two small towns.
That's it.
So we got a connection through that.
A very angry bridge. Yeah.
But what are you to do when literally there is literally probably only one other lesbian in the village?
That's exactly right, Rosie. You're going to
cross paths.
You are. And that's how we met.
Of course it goes without saying. So what kind of children were you?
Oh, stunning.
I mean, that goes without saying.
That's a really
for both of you, of course.
Interesting and strange question.
Do you know what? That's a really good question. I've never been asked. I'm gonna step right up here and say that I was probably quite an insecure, very shy child. Really into the arts, really artistic, but very not very confident. Not very confident in myself at all.
And a tomboy, I'd say.
A tomboy. I used to want to just hang with the boys. I exclusively pretty much had boy-only friends, and I didn't feel very comfortable in like a girly girl scenario in school. Mm. So I was kind of like a bit of a floater. I hate referring to myself as a floater, but I was. I kind of drifted between sort of like little social groups. So that was me. What were you like?
I think I was a loud, dramatic...
Really?
annoying child, teenager.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
You were prom
flirty,
queen, though.
Flirty, as prom queen.
Yeah, that was not what I was.
Prom queen. So were you quite... Yeah. Rosie, were you quite popular at school?
I don't know.
Rose is nodding her head.
I think I see you as Miss Popular. That's how you came across. Whether they all hated you is another story, isn't it?
Yeah.
You appeared to have a lot of friends.
I had a big reputation, and I don't really know how I got that reputation.
But like people knew who you were.
Yeah, but that's people nice. In other years knew who I was, and I was like, who are you?
Oh, wow, no one knew who I was.
But I didn't like do anything. I was just being me.
Yeah, I think you were just confident.
Yeah,
I
was very loud and
confident.
Yeah, very loud and confident.
Yeah.
So, Rose, you being sort of insecure and sort of a bit shyer.
Yes.
Do you think that was sort of linked to your sexuality?
Oh, certainly. I think so. I mean, I always started off quite shy as a child, ever since I got told off at a National Trust exhibition
yes.
for crossing over the red rope.
That scarred Rose for life, genuinely.
But in terms of sexuality, I feel like I was never really very comfortable within myself, and I never really knew why. And I think that thing I couldn't really quite put my finger on, really, I carried that for a really long time until I was sort of early teens, I think, and I realised, oh, I'm gay.
So was it before that you knew you were different and you didn't know why before?
Different as in very special, yes, but also different to my other peers also, because, yeah, I feel like I couldn't really understand what my feelings meant, and I therefore I couldn't really place myself within friendship groups, within school, within anything. I wasn't really comfortable being anything because I wasn't sure what it was.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think definitely my sexuality came into my, you know, shyness, my lack of confidence. And then it was only really when I realised that I was gay and I thought, oh, do you know what? That's okay. When I was about 14, that's when I really sort of began to be more confident and think, yeah, well, do you know what? That's just who I am and that's actually really great. And I'm not going to tell anyone yet, because I want to keep that my special secret, live with it for a while, become more confident, and I'll tell people when I'm ready.
So I don't know whether you feel similar to me and to other people that have been on the show, that there wasn't an awful lot of sort of gay female representation out there.
Nothing.
As a teenager.
It was very limited. I had the Willow and Tara story arc of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Of course.
Which was actually my staple coming out pair that I really latched myself onto emotionally, because I was like, well, you know what, if Willow's doing it and she's doing like the dark arts, that's all very cool.
The dark arts.
So I thought, you know what, I'm exactly the same. I can relate to this. So that was the one thing that I had. And you know what, I know people say, you know, oh, that show saved my life, or even somewhat about our content too. I don't want to like blow my own trumpet here, but people say, oh no, you really helped me, and I think, oh, that's nice. But when you really think about it, that show Buffy the Vampire Slayer really did help me, you know. Yeah. And people need to have that representation to be comfortable sometimes with themselves.
But before Buffy there was literally no one.
No, like, I don't think there were. Well, I don't, I not in my lifetime, I
not that I knew of. There was no TV shows. When I got a bit older, there was like the odd Hollyoaks storyline, which wouldn't last
sure.
that long,
but they'd be in Hollyoaks Lates, of course.
Yeah, yes,
of course.
Yeah, exactly.
And didn't she fall? Didn't she do a jump from a plane and then die? That they killed her
yes,
off
they
quickly.
Killed. They killed off the first like.
Oh, they love killing off lesbians.
They do love it. They
and
do.
Wasn't there a guy who came out as gay and he also died?
Oh, probably. They're probably all dead.
Yeah, they're all dead.
Yeah.
So when I grew up, I was quite confidently bisexual. I knew I was bisexual, and do you know, I never know where I heard the word to describe it. I don't remember. I was just like, yeah, that's me.
Was it MySpace?
I don't know. I have no idea. But I just went into school like I'm like high school. Like, I am bisexual, and I told everybody.
I love that you had the confidence to do that.
Well, Susie, it wasn't the confidence, it was the lack of foresight. You know, it was the lack of thinking. See, this is the thing. I was this very loud, confident person. But I never really thought, you know, how are people around me thinking
about me? I've got a question for you, Rosie. It's mildly problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's easier to come out as bisexual in school as opposed to come out as a lesbian?
Yes, but also, like, oh, it's so annoying. Like, loads of people said they were bi in school and then, like, now
guilty.
Say they're not.
Guilty.
And then,
yeah, guilty.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
No, so I don't mind if
well,
you say
actually,
you're bi.
That wasn't at school. It was a bit later, but I definitely had the...
Yeah, same.
The stepping stone.
The stepping
the
stone.
The journey.
Yeah. I don't mind if someone queer says they're bi and then later comes out as gay because... Maybe they genuinely thought they were bi.
That's
maybe
true.
They were hoping they were bi. And I do understand that it's a way to ease family and other people in.
I know what you're gonna say.
I still like men, but I don't.
But you hate it when straight people say they're bi.
For attention.
For attention.
Which also happened.
It did happen back in the day a lot, didn't it?
I think it's...
There was a lot of that with pop stars, wasn't there?
Mm. Oh my God, or Jessie J.
There was a lot of that with sort of Jessie... Yeah, Jessie J. I mean, I'm still quite annoyed about that.
Yeah, I really am. She literally is like, no, it was a phase. And also things like...
It's like, that's very unhelpful. That's very unhelpful to the cause, mate.
Yeah, it is. And, it's very unhelpful.
I don't know what Katy Perry identifies as, but obviously she made that song, I Kissed a Girl and I Liked It, and then kind of just married a man and then married another man.
She didn't like it that much, did she?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's very frustrating. So I did tell everybody, but I think also it's part of... The reason I told everybody was I couldn't hold it in, like, people just knew. Like, yeah. I'm not very good at hiding my emotions, so everybody knew.
That's fair.
Yeah. But there was no one. And then when I went to uni, I studied media and cultural studies, and we did classes on gay actors. And my teacher was like, you know, do you think there are loads of closeted actors? And we were like, no. And they were like, okay, so name some out gay actors. And no one could name one person. All I could think of is Ellen DeGeneres, who's not really an actor.
It's funny though, because naively, when I was younger... much younger than I am now, I didn't think that being out would affect my career in any way, because I thought, well, how ridiculous, of course it won't, that's so prehistoric, that doesn't happen anymore. And it's actually only as I've gotten to this stage that I realise actually it affects you quite a lot still.
But what's frustrating is it does affect you. It is a thing that affects you, you know, like with intersectionality, being part of the LGBTQ plus community affects your life. But then there are these people like Jessie J who then benefit from it by boosting their career and maybe their demographic by saying, yeah, I'm bi. And then when it doesn't suit them anymore, like, no, that was just a phase.
Ah, but you have to admit, though, back in the earlier days of YouTube, sort of around 2015, 2016, we would never get a brand deal. And our management at the time, we had several different managements, they'd always say the same thing. Oh, you two are difficult to place. And I knew what they meant. They meant, oh, you're gay, you're married, we don't know how to market you, we don't know what you are.
And we were like, okay, well, we'll tell you where to place us. We have a gaming channel so we could promote games.
Yeah.
We were like, we have a lifestyle vlog channel so we could do like food, lifestyle
products. We like tech, food.
And they were like, yes, but you're very difficult to place, to sell to. It's funny. Now things are opening up and we get opportunities now and we're treated more as equals. But yeah, definitely. But I think the one thing about being on this podcast and being in our 30s is, we can remember how difficult it was.
Yeah, it was difficult at the beginning.
When I was at drama school, I remember one of the teachers saying to me, you should say you're bisexual because it'll be easier for casting rather than being out. I mean, which now I'm like, God, I wish you hadn't done that when I was in such a formative place as a 21-year-old.
Right, vulnerable.
Right.
But when I had Laura Checkley, who's an actress on the show last series, we had like a big conversation about sort of coming out at drama school and the fact that for a long time she was quite concerned that she'd only ever be cast in gay roles, and she's in King Gary now, which is and playing King Gary's wife. But yeah, it's interesting how scared people were to like pigeonhole a brand on something, or you know, to be something specific. So did you came out as bisexual at school? Did you come out at school as well, Rose?
No. I came out when I was about, I think I was 16 to my sister and then 19 to the rest of my family and my friends. But again, I came out as bisexual because I thought it would be easier to swallow for everybody else.
Right.
But it was quite tricky because my sister was great. She was really, really supportive as ever. And my parents were, it took them some time, but they are fully on board now. And obviously, you know, it takes everybody a little time to adapt, especially when you have an idea of how you think your child's going to be. And when that sort of deviates, it, you know, it must be a bit of a shock at first. So all is forgiven. But then when I told my friends, it was almost boring. They were so unaffected. And there was really no drama, which is a bit of a shame.
What's interesting is, Rose, is when you finally came out, you came out as bisexual to ease in. I told everyone I was bisexual. And then when I started up my relationship with Rose, I bumped into an old flame at a club that was a man. And he was like, oh, hi, Rose. Yeah, here, you're lesbian now. So it's like, oh,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter what you say.
Yeah. Yeah, you are a lesbian now, though, aren't you? No, No, I know. It's a weird one. But I think generally speaking, our coming out experiences, they weren't too traumatic, were they?
They weren't too bad.
They weren't too bad. Obviously, we've had our hurdles, you know, as a lesbian and a bisexual woman. But generally speaking, I think we had it pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now you're out in sort of a very public way. So let's talk a little bit about that. So is it true that you started your YouTube channel, Rose, because of uni or something, trying to get something to go viral?
That's it. So I had to make a music video. Basically, I did film and screen media at uni, and one of the modules was all about sort of like online content. And this was before sort of YouTube was a real sort of arena of competitive, I want to be famous.
You know? I mean, I've said this to you girls before, but I distinctly remember someone saying to me when I first started comedy, you should get a YouTube channel. And I remember saying, that won't go anywhere. And so, you know, I've always really had my finger on the pulse with the next big thing. But yeah, you clearly had the foresight to see that it was going to be...
Well, not the foresight. No, you were told to do it.
Not really. I was exactly that. I was told right, to do it. Thank you, Rosie. So yeah, so I did it as a module for a part of my university degree. And it was all about, you know, how do you make something go viral? Blah blah blah, and I started it really as a bit of a hobby because I wanted like a creative outlet, a bit of a platform just to be silly, and it kind of just snowballed. And then I met Rosie, and I honestly just used it as an excuse to make videos with Rosie so I could see her. I was like, oh, you know, I've got this YouTube channel, we can be funny on it and stuff, and you know, we'll have to get together every week and make a video. I mean, no one's watching, but whatever.
But it was not for a career. Like, we didn't know you could make money from it. We didn't know.
I don't think you could back then, though.
No, we weren't making any money, we were just doing it.
Yeah, we certainly
and
weren't.
And also, I didn't think we didn't realize like the reach of what we were doing, and so we would literally sit there and talk about everything very candidly, no barriers, not thinking about people judging us online or who would see this or what would happen.
But we just did it. To be fair to us, though, I still feel like we create content with that kind of like same vibe.
Yeah, we do.
But obviously now you have to be more careful about, you know, being responsible for the things you talk about and the things that you say, and also, you know, demonetization, and you know, is it suitable for everybody? So there are slightly more sort of limitations, but we've always just said everything, you know, shared everything, and that's just kind of just who we are, I guess.
And people started watching, and I honestly don't know how, but we immediately garnered an LGBTQ+ audience. I think, I don't know how they found us, because also, on YouTube, you tag your videos, right? Like, hashtag, like, lesbian couple, but same-sex couple. We didn't tag our videos because we didn't use that feature. We just, like,
didn't write it properly in the description box.
Yeah, like, you're meant to write, like, what the video's about. We didn't have, like...
It's called metadata.
Yeah, we didn't do any of the SEO, any of the metadata. We didn't do it properly.
We
literally
didn't
would just upload a video, and somehow all these people found us and were asking us questions about our relationship and stuff. And that was quite daunting for me as well, because Rose was my first proper, like, girlfriend, and then we've ended up getting married.
Yeah.
So that was quite scary as well, because it didn't put pressure on it, but it was weird.
Do you think it helped our relationship at all? Sorry, I'm being the interviewer.
No, this is great. It's like I'm just at your house and I'm just watching.
Well, I'll never know if it did, because so this is an interesting thing about me and Rose. So as soon as we started dating, literally the second date, I think Rose got whipped the camera out and we filmed a video. So yeah.
I tell you what, I've been on other dates where someone's whipped out a camera, but it's not. Yeah. I mean,
and then we made a YouTube video. Yeah. After that, we made a YouTube video. But So Rose is saying, you know, do you think it affected our relationship? I'll never know, because we've never done our relationship without YouTube. Obviously, one day we will, because one day I'm not going to work to the rest of my life, you know. One day there'll be an end.
Rosie,
to
I'm retiring. I'm going to make you work.
So have you done a video every week since then?
Not every week, because we didn't used to do it every week, because we were both at uni and stuff. So yeah. Rose would drive over and we'd film a couple of videos.
We're pretty consistent, though.
After we've been doing it for a couple of years, an agency approached Rose and was like, hey, you know, we can sign you. We're very naive, and they like took a really high percentage
for doing 50% of our money.
So this is when we started earning money and it became a thing. And they were like, this is years later, like we did it for years, not making any money, just like chilling out. Mm. And then this agency approached us and was like, right, you really should try and make a video once a week. And we were like, oh, okay, but we had jobs, we had uni. Mm. And we were like, okay, we'll try. But obviously we have missed weeks. So not every week, but for 10 years in October.
I'd say we did all
right. We started dating 10 years in October, we've been making videos.
And we still enjoy doing it. And yeah, I think that's why we're still doing it, though. Because I think as soon as you start hating your job,
It's time just, to move
it's
on.
Time to,
yeah.
It's time to, yeah. If you're in the position to stop, then maybe think about stopping.
We've always said if we didn't enjoy it, then we'd stop. And we always said as well, we'd put our relationship before the job. You can get another job, but... Yeah. I mean, you can get another relationship, but can you get another relationship like ours, you know?
Absolutely not.
So those are our kind of rules. Yeah. Like, if we're not enjoying it, we will stop doing it. And if it affects our relationship, we put the relationship first.
Yeah.
Like, I genuinely think you girls have done such a brilliant job of, like, normalising lives like ours.
Thank you.
I think it's... No, but I think it's really important. Like, you know, I know that when, you know, I get up on stage, I want to just be able to talk about... I just want to be funny. And I happen to have a girlfriend and I happen to be, you know, but I just want our lives to be normal. So yes. I haven't got to go, here's loads of coming out material. I appreciate I'm saying this on a coming out podcast, which I did create, but let's gloss over that. But you know what I mean? Like, I feel like certainly like, oh my God, if I was like 15 now and you guys existed, I would have saved quite a lot of money in therapy. I think I would have been like, oh, well, I might meet someone that's really lovely and have a really happy time together.
That's so nice.
And so... Is there like, let's start with this question. Have you ever felt like you've overshared too much? Because I love how much you overshare. And I do that because I'm a stand-up. I'm always talking.
No, I don't feel like we have. I've never regretted anything that I've shared.
Anything you put online.
Apart from my address. No, I'm joking.
anything you put online, someone has an opinion about it. And so there might be someone out there who twists your words or something like that. But I think we've come to realise that, you know, not everyone in the world's going to like us, but I'm not going to change myself to cater to people.
And do you know what's
it's
really
a dangerous
funny?
Game.
What's really funny is it's only now, at this point in our career, after 10 years, that we have started to develop a slightly thicker skin. Maybe it's the climate at the moment. Maybe it's the pandemic. But, you know, the internet is quite turbulent. It's quite sensitive at the moment, which is understandable. You know, we have overshared our entire lives. And now I think we're at the stage where... If we do say something, we think, oh, is that okay to share? And we are more kind of like, you know, thinking about, is that okay?
But I think that's nice, though, because it's just being responsible.
It's being responsible. It's being respectful. But I don't regret anything that I have shared up until now. No, not at all.
No.
I hope that's why our channel is seemingly popular with people, because, you know, we don't really have a filter and we've always been very honest about who we are. And I started the channel being openly out as a lesbian because, as you said, Susie, I just wanted it to be normalised. I didn't want to make it a gay channel. I mean, it probably is a gay channel, but I'm not here preaching about, you know, it's okay to be gay. Like, I'm just doing it. And if someone else has got a problem, that's their problem, you know. And I think that's the kind of ethos that we've tried to sort of like really bring through over the last 10 years.
Do you get much, or have you over the last decade, because I'm sure it's changing constantly, but have you experienced much homophobia?
No.
Honestly, not online.
No,
we do. We get the very occasional homophobia that we get is not our audience. So if we did a video that went viral that got, you know, a million hits or more, and it's not our usual audience who tunes in kind of weekly to see what we're up to, then you get comments and it's starkly obvious that it's not our audience.
Do you read comments?
We do read comments. Yeah, we absolutely read and we respond because you know. That's the point. It's we're making this for our audience, and we talk to our audience,
and we
ask them what they want.
You know.
Yeah, but you can tell who's writing the comments, and sometimes they're like just stuff like, "Oh, you know, it's a sin, and you're going to go to hell." It's normally stuff like that. Save yourself.
Best sin I've ever made. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love
just,
that.
Normally quite like religious or quite
but,
preaching.
You know, it's so few and far between.
Yeah,
I think we are very, very lucky,
and
indeed.
We don't care really because
no,
it's like,
care.
Well,
that
what am I gonna do? You
for
know,
some reason. That's never really hurt me.
No.
That's never hurt me because I just think, well, that's your opinion. You're entitled to it, but that's just your opinion. Like, it does not bother me at all. Obviously, it's not very nice to read if someone passionately says something really quite negative about who you are as a person. But, you know, we've been so lucky over the last 10 years. We've never really had any kind of hate, have we?
No. I think if anything, if we'd ever experienced homophobia, it would be like mild discrimination rather than our audience actively being horrible because our audience are accepting.
Well, of
that's
course.
We've garnered an audience that are LGBTQ+.
Exactly.
They're accepting people,
and we're very lucky too, I will say, because our audience are a really kind bunch of people. They're very respectful of each other. You know, we can see how they engage, you know, online with each other when we meet up at events back in the day when you could meet people face to face. You know, they all make these connections from our videos, and that brings me so much joy.
You can see that in the comments.
Yeah, it's great.
That they'll like comment on the back of each other, and it's like
totally.
The only reason I reacted is that, and I guess it's a different thing, but if you put stand up online, you don't read the comments,
right?
Because, like, you just don't read the comments.
Do you know, I've got. I was going to ask you, Susie. I was going to ask
you. Do you read reviews then?
Is it tough being a stand up comedian? Like, just because of people being offended?
I haven't had another job for a really long time.
Right.
So it's very normal to me now, right, to people to have an instant reaction to something I'm doing.
Right. So have you had to develop like a thick skin over your career?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've been homophobically heckled in like most towns across the country at some point.
Really? So you're saying that they paid to come and see you and then they were homophobic?
It's usually when it's on like a mixed bill.
Right.
And
okay.
So like
right,
so earlier in, like nowadays I tour, but like earlier in my career, actually I'd still do mixed bills now. Mm. But I had some really tough stuff early doors where someone shouted out, "I could fuck you straight."
Oh my God. The audacity.
I asked the venue to put the lights on and I asked him to stand up and I explained all the reasons why he wouldn't be the one to fuck me straight.
Oh my God, well done.
That is beautiful. What a moment.
Yeah, I came off stage and I was so horrible to him, I felt like I needed to take a shower.
Well,
that was the meanest I've ever been. But he'll never shout at a lesbian again.
No, I think you owned it.
He'll never shout at a queer person again.
Wow.
But yeah, I think it's sort of similar, you know, our work life does sort of cross over in places because you share yourself and you, I mean, it took me quite a long time to develop a thick skin, certainly when it comes to the homophobic stuff and people shouting out,
for sure,
which is something, because I think that if I was just like a surprise on the bill, you know, but now on tour shows, I did have some weird homophobia at a tour show once. Which was really strange because he had paid specifically to watch me for an hour and a half.
Odd.
And like, I've got sort of a 50-50 straight and queer audience.
Right.
And it was really sad because there were clearly some very young lesbians there. And
right.
I was just like, oh, I don't want you to have to experience this.
Right. No. So you have to carry that. That's hard. That's
tough.
Yeah,
but also it wasn't your fault they were experiencing it.
No,
and they are going to experience
Maybe totally. I made them wait afterwards and made sure they were okay.
Yeah. That's really nice. But does that mean that you then have the responsibility of making sure that your queer young audience haven't been affected by these, you know, odd, you know, assholes that just decide to pipe up?
Do you know, it's funny you say about pressure, because that was one of the next questions I was going to ask you guys, is that do you now have like this pressure to be, let me word this right, because I don't want this to come across in a negative way, because how I said to you before, I genuinely mean about you guys being such a positive thing that's in the world. I'm so pleased you guys exist and the channel exists. But is there like a pressure on that to be like you were saying before, Rosie, you were saying about like, you know, we wouldn't put the channel before our relationship. Is there like a pressure for it to continue existing because all these people love it and obviously it's your job now, but taking that slightly out of the equation, because, you know, jobs will change and things will evolve, like things constantly evolve online, like, is there a pressure to like these people that absolutely love you, that tune in every week, that are like, I want to know everything, tell me everything now, I want to, you know, is there a pressure there?
The only pressure I feel is that the way YouTube works best is it likes you to upload really regularly, and I would love to upload less videos but even better content, right? So I'm sure as a stand-up you probably go away and build your comedy routine.
A lot of it, that you write a lot of shit, and then you might get like, out of 10 pages of shit, there'll be one page that's like, that's almost funny.
Right.
And
I'm sure there's ad lib as well, but you know, you live life and that, you know, that's how you get your comedy, right?
Right.
And so
totally.
The only annoying thing is that YouTube is like a machine that is churning out all this content daily. So it's not my audience that put me under pressure. It's that to continue on YouTube, you have to do that. You have to work quite hard. And I would rather, you know,
so that you can comment on your experience.
Yeah, because we used to.
Yeah, like if you go on holiday, do you have to take a camera?
Do you know, we don't have to.
We don't have to, but we always say we won't film on holiday. We'll have a holiday. But actually, we, one, miss filming because we do it all the time. And two, we're like, I want to film.
Yeah, it's funny.
We love filming.
This is why I know we're doing the right thing by continuing this job, because we genuinely love documenting stuff. For us, though, you know, for us. Yeah. So if we went to Kefalonia a few years ago and we were like, we're not going to film. We're going to have a nice break. We're going to just like totally detach. And then we ended up filming the whole thing and having a great time. And we were like, oh, well, we've got that now and we can always watch that.
Yeah,
you know?
And we enjoy our jobs, and some of our best memories are filming certain things. Even for people might not believe it, but we filmed during the pandemic last summer. We filmed a brand deal with...
LG,
a laptop. And that was one of my best memories of the summer. One of my best memories.
We just had so much fun.
We
doing
have fun
it.
Being creative. We enjoy, if we do something scripted, we enjoy that. If it's not, it's not.
We bought a drone to try and be like really professional and get these drone shots, and just us trying to like pilot this thing was so much
yeah,
fun.
It was a great memory. It was like summer.
But back to your original question, sorry to digress, but with the pressure thing with the LGBT.
No, I love the digressing. I love the digressing.
I'd never felt much of a pressure until someone called us role models, and I thought, whoa, that looks like
that was scary.
I have said that I am a role model. And I've never said that. But now I think that it's a lovely thing to be called a role model. And I would love to be considered a role model. I don't feel like there's pressure, though, because I feel like because I've always just been myself and Rosie's always just been herself, we don't have to act a certain way to fulfill this role model status.
I will also add, we feel pressure when so things like live tours and live panels, a lot of pressure, because I remember my first ever panel we did at Summer City, and this is like in 2014, and again, you know, you are my first, you know, proper same-sex relationship, so you know, I don't have all this experience, you know, I was really young, and we went on a panel and someone put their hand up and said, I've got a question for Rose and Rosie. And we were like, yeah. And they were like, I live in Russia. And at the time, there was this terrible homophobia going on in Russia, like terrible, terrible things were happening.
I mean, yeah, I think there's still stuff going on there. Now. I mean, yeah, it's pretty horrific for queer people.
Yeah, I'd specifically read something terrible on the news about gay people having their teeth pulled out, like something terrible. Like, and they said, I'm from Russia and I want to come out. What should I do? Oh. And I was like, I don't know. Excellent question. Like, you know, how can I ask that and be responsible for? I don't want to give someone the wrong information and then them be in trouble.
Panels are actually live events, especially LGBTQ plus panels, are one of my biggest kind of most nerve-wracking experiences because I always want to be saying the right things, but obviously you don't know what you're going to get asked. It's all live. You haven't got a lot of time to think. And I think in terms of pressure, those are the most highly pressured scenarios.
And as much research as you can do, I don't know all the rules and regulations of every single country, and I don't know everything about everything. Like, I'll try and be as updated as I can. And that's a pressure. That's a pressure.
You know, I'm sure you've had it from other people as well. Like, I get people emailing in this show saying, how shall I tell my mum I'm gay? And you sort of go, I can't tell you that because I didn't do a great job with my mum. So I don't know how I can tell you to do a good job with yours.
Right, it's really hard. And it's all circumstantial. So it's really difficult to say, well, there is only one way and this is the way to do it. You know, it's tough.
People send us messages with different religions, different cultural backgrounds,
but all we can do is offer our support, you know, either way. And
yeah,
you know,
totally.
And we always try and say, you know, before you, you know, don't feel like you have to act, you know, why don't you just sit there with yourself for a while and get comfortable being you, just for a while anyway, so you feel more confident for when you are going to come out, that, you know, you're happy inside, and that's the first and foremost thing to do, right?
Be comfortable with you.
But you're right, there is a lot of pressure, and we don't have all the answers.
But
you know?
While we're talking about pressure, Susie, I'd love to turn it around, because I get incredibly nervous for our live tours.
Right.
Like, I get angry and say, I'm quitting. I'm quitting YouTube.
I regret it all.
I'm going to go home and get the most boring job I could possibly find. And I'm just going to live my life like that. I get so angry. And then at the end of the show, I'm like, oh my God, let's do it again. I'm like, I can't sleep. Like, can't come down from the adrenaline. So are you the same? Like,
what's your process,
have you got
Susie?
Used to live touring? You probably do a bit more than we do.
So in normal times, I'll probably do about 200 gigs a year.
Wow, that's
a lot.
Oh my God.
Our tours, we did like 10 shows once.
But that wouldn't be all my own tour. I don't do that many tour dates by myself, but because I gig and I'll be like working up material, and then I'll be going around the country. I sometimes open for bigger acts.
Right.
So I'll go and open for Josh Widdicombe or Alan Carr or whoever else and go on the road with them as well. So I go on stage as much as you, well, probably more than you guys.
Much more.
upload videos. Like, I would be very nervous to do a YouTube video.
Oh, really?
Well, that makes sense, though.
Like, I would be very nervous because I would just be like, oh God, I'm going to be shit. I'm going to be really bad at this. I don't know how to be me.
Do you know what? I don't think it's that, though. I don't think it's that you don't know you know, what you do. I think it's just because you can't predict what a new audience on a totally different platform will be like. I think that's what it is. I'd be nervous to start. This is why I haven't started TikTok. First of all, I don't understand it. Second of all, I feel like I'm too old. And third of all,
me too.
I honestly feel like if I started it, a whole new platform now, I'm too nervous. Too nervous. I'd probably be great.
No, almost certainly. But Rosie, sorry, to answer your question properly, I got really nervous for a really long time, to the point where sometimes I would pull over and be sick at service stations.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I used to get very, very nervous. Now, if I'm doing something like a big TV show, like I did The Last Leg last week, and that's live on Channel 4 on a Friday.
How?
And so that's like... So, like, I know the subjects we're going to cover because I've read the news that week. So, I've got gags on each of those, but I can't have notes because there's no death.
I can do
so
it.
So, then
Susie.
You're just, like, in the moment trying to be really funny. And so that's just before they go, Susie Ruffell's one of our guests tonight. Then I have a moment of complete calm. Then the whole time I'm doing the show, I'm completely calm. And then when I come off stage, I'm, like, on a massive high.
Yeah.
And so... So, but with, like, just gigging regularly, just turning up at gigs and doing them live, I think just because you get so used to
right.
it. But I still really enjoy it. And I get nervous when I'm trying new stuff.
I think that's good. I think nerves means that you care. And
oh,
if you
but
care,
too many is uncontrollable.
I do hate them.
It's the diarrhea for me.
And for me.
Yeah.
Sure. And listen, I think a pre-performance poo is very normal.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you should have... I think PPP is very normal.
Yeah. Definitely. And you had one during, didn't you? That Toronto?
No, it was it was our last one in New York. It was our biggest one.
She had to come off
on
pretty
stage,
early. Pretty.
I realised, wow... I need to hold this clench, else
don't
who knows
heart.
What will
exactly.
happen.
Oh, that happened on stage.
Yeah, on stage. And then we had an interval.
And so did you leave the stage? Oh,
we
thank
had
God
an
for the interval.
I had to run off. But we were filming our documentary at the time. Yeah. So we had cameras following me and they wanted to like talk to us. And I was like, go away.
Just overshare and deal with it,
yeah,
Rosie.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I mean?
Terrible.
Yeah, come on, Rosie. Be brave, for God's sake. Come on, mate.
But yeah, that happened. So... You just never know, do you?
Before we finish, I would love to talk to you a little bit about your podcast and also about like how you're documenting your sort of journey to parenthood.
Yes.
It's so great to see queer women, or queer people rather, being parents, like, you know, however they choose to do it.
Yeah.
And was that something that you thought, did you always know that you wanted to become mums? And did you always know that you'd share it?
I actually... never really felt that maternal.
No, me neither.
Up.
We didn't want to become mums. We said no, didn't we?
We were like, no. We are doing everything we want to do. We don't want to have any responsibility.
Yeah.
And then that cliched moment of when you get to sort of like early 30s, it doesn't happen for everybody, but it does happen for some people. We were like, oh my God, I want a baby.
Yeah, it just changed.
I have absolutely no wisdom to pass on, but I would love to have a child.
Yeah, things shifted. Our priorities changed. We were like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
We weren't planning on this, but fine.
Exactly. And I think it was that point we were like, do you know what would be really valuable as well? To document our journey, because we have no idea how to do this. The information is seriously lacking. It's very confusing. It's very different depending on where you live in the country.
The information was terrible.
Yeah, can you explain that? Could you explain that, how it's different, please? Whereabouts are you based? We don't need to keep this in
if
you don't tell
anyone.
No,
we can. We can. We're in the Cotswolds.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're
oh,
in the
lovely.
Cotswolds.
Yeah, so we're quite sort of rural.
We live near...
rural.
Natalie Imbruglia, who's also in the Cotswolds, who hasn't she just adopted?
Just had, no, she
or
just,
did she surrogate?
She's just had her first baby at 45 with a sperm donor.
That's
interesting.
A sperm
enough.
Donor. That's it.
I
that's
think
why
that's
I
all
know.
Accurate. We might have to check that.
I'm yeah. sure that you can knock on the door.
I'm
sure.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We're
you know
kind of doing a similar thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Hi.
We have a lot.
Natalie,
in
it's been a while.
I'm desperately trying to find something to use torn alongside
yeah.
giving birth. I mean, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. But that is how my brain is sort of trying to find a joke in those words. 100%
a connection. 100%. So there are some queer people on YouTube documenting having children, but all the ones I knew of are in America or other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's different. They have totally different system.
Yeah.
You know, they have different things like insurance. Like, it's done differently.
Mm.
So we had no idea how to start. And I think this is what led us to making the podcast. Mm. Is that, so we were like, okay, we now decided we want children. Change of plan.
What now?
What the hell now? And I went to my doctor. I was there for a routine checkup anyway. And I said, if me and my wife want to have a baby, where do we go? And my doctor was like, I don't know. Sorry. Don't know. And But my daughter was like, I don't know. And I was like, okay. And then in the end, we randomly happened to have a lawyer, an entertainment lawyer, who is happens to be in a queer relationship as well. And so we were like, what did you do? And they were like, well, we went to a talk at this place in Brighton. So she was like, so you could start there?
Of course.
So we went along to this talk in Brighton.
It was like an open evening for...
But it's specifically for queer women, wasn't
it? Queer women, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was all about sort of...
I haven't been to an open evening in years.
Oh, it was a very enjoyable. It was really nice.
It was
actually
a really nice day. We went on our anniversary,
we
did
on our wedding anniversary.
Yes.
Yeah, we actually did.
Yeah, we did.
We got more information. It wasn't all the information, but we knew sort of how we had to start the process. You know, pick a sperm bank first. The clinic is not the sperm bank. You have to have the sperm shipped to the clinic.
And the clinic has to accept your sperm bank. Certain clinics don't work with certain banks. Certain clinics have their own sperm bank. There's sort of politics there.
Is it UK eligible sperm? Because some sperm that you might fall in love with a sperm donor online and you might not be able to get it shipped to the UK.
Yeah.
There's lots
of
hurdles.
Or you might have to plan to travel abroad.
To be inseminated abroad.
Yeah.
So there's lots and lots going on, and also it's astronomically expensive,
and there are many different routes, and it depends on your body and what you're capable of.
There's IVF, there's IUI, there's
other things. There's a different type of IVF, there's several IVFs.
There's a lot to learn.
There's surrogacy, there's adoption, and then also when we looked into the adoption route as well.
Yep.
And then another thing is, other than the Brighton clinic, I did try calling a local Cotswold clinic, and they definitely weren't catering for queer people, because I'm calling because I want to try and make a baby. You know, I kind of like rang up like, hi,
I've got some paper mache.
And I was like, do you do IUI? Because on the website it only said IVF. So IUI is just, for people who don't know, is just like putting sperm into you.
It's like artificial insemination.
Yeah. So kind of like sex, but with like a turkey baster.
But that's not IUI. Quite as romantic.
IVF's a bit different, where they take out the egg and then they put it back in. And so I was like, oh, on your website, so you're local, I saw you do IVF, but do you do IUI? And the woman went, we don't even know if you need it. Have you been investigated? And I was like, oh, I need it.
Yeah. What does that mean?
They
immediately assumed we had fertility issues.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even, the fact that we were gay wasn't even remotely considered.
And so we were like, oh, we're not going to go with you guys.
I don't think you're quite ready for us yet. No. So it's been quite difficult where we live, but I think it's different if you do live in Brighton, maybe it would be easier.
And I wanted people to know how to do it without literally following this like weird clue, like kind of trail of crumbs.
Yeah.
And it would be really great if we could tell people.
You'll get a key. Yes. Inside the house, there'll be a booklet.
Yes.
On the booklet, there is a number. You call that number.
Yeah.
Like.
Exactly.
And how has that been, sort of sharing? Because I know that it's been a journey to get there. Like, how's that been sort of sharing everything?
I've actually really enjoyed sharing everything. It was difficult when we lost a baby, because obviously we couldn't really not share that, because we're oversharers anyway. I didn't feel like I had to, but I feel like it was really important to. And I think that's been the hardest bit of the journey to share, but also one that we didn't think, you know, wouldn't happen. We obviously thought, well, the baby process is very, very up and down for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Nothing is clear cut. And just if you have a positive pregnancy test, that does not necessarily mean you have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those were lessons we had to learn. And I do think that we've, you know, drawn a lot of attention to the possibility of having a miscarriage and what to do in that situation. So I feel like hopefully that horrible experience has opened up conversation around it, because, you know, one of my biggest grievances about having a miscarriage was the misinformation that I received about what it would be like. And now I realise it would be different for a lot of people at different stages of pregnancy.
But we've heard this from a lot of other people, though, who've had a miscarriage, that they weren't told what it was going to be like.
Exactly. And there's almost this element of shame around it. And I really wanted to break that down and be like, you know what, you know, you guys didn't do anything wrong if you've lost a baby through a miscarriage. You know, it's just one of those unfortunate things. And I think we did a really good job in bringing that to the focus. But I've really enjoyed the whole process. It's actually been quite therapeutic for me anyway, from last year's terrible experience.
Yeah. And also it was just the next step. Like we said, we started off 10 years ago dating, kind of being ridiculous in my flat, you know, just chatting. And they've watched us get engaged and get married. And now we're going through the baby making journey, and I think that it's only natural that we want to share.
Yeah, and also I wanted to highlight, you know, that our journey has been so positive, but life isn't always amazing. And I think that it's that's something very real and raw about sharing the times where it's sad. And, you know, bad things happen sometimes. So, you know, I love our podcast. I think I'm hoping it's helping a lot of people on their journeys, you know, whether it's, you know, in the creation of a baby or if anyone suffered from loss. So I'm really happy that we've done it.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think it's great. Right, the final question of the show. And I'm going to ask you a slightly different moment. So Rose, for you, mm-hmm. when you were that sort of shy child at school, you maybe had just realised you're gay, you're 14. If you could go back and give either that girl or someone like you, if you don't want to...
Right.
Gokwan had a bit real issue with going back and talking to himself because he thought it would change his life. So it could be someone that's in a similar position to you now. If you could give them a little bit of advice, what would you say?
Oh, that's a very good question. I'd say go easy on yourself, because it's very easy to really freak out when you're uncertain of how you feel about things. And I think that if you just allow yourself the time to grow inside as a person, don't feel like you automatically, immediately need to share the way that you're feeling with all of your family if you don't want to. If you think that it would bring you comfort in some way, then by all means go for it. But I feel like sometimes people think, oh, I might be gay. I immediately need to tell people for other people to validate who I am. It's like, mm-hmm. no, you don't need to do that. I think it's important to sit there and really love yourself for being you and really kind of get rid of any shameful feelings you might have about yourself before you decide to include people on a really special secret and something that makes you a really amazing person. And I just feel like, you know, that's yours to own. That's precious to you and treat it like other people's gift to know. That would be my advice.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
That is perfect, actually. And Rosie, I noted that throughout the interview when you spoke about sort of your first relationship with a woman being with Rose, and that you were, you know, maybe a bit anxious about it or worried about going into that. If you could go back to that version of you, so I guess like 10 years ago now, and give her a bit of advice, or someone like you, if you agree with Gok, what would you say?
I think I'd tell myself that I don't have to worry about lack of experience with other women, because there's no right or wrong way to be in a same-sex relationship.
Yeah.
And so I was so freaked out because I kind of entered this world of lesbianism, like Rose showed me like the L word and stuff like that. And
the Bible.
It was all this culture about like U-Hauls and cats and all the lesbian stereotypes.
The
and I was like, oh my God, I've no idea what's going on. But actually it doesn't matter because... Yeah, that has no effect, because your relationship's going to be different with whoever you're with and whoever you are. And so I think I'd say to myself, stop worrying and chill out. And
just do and just enjoy.
Yeah, just enjoy it.
Yeah.
It all works out in the end.
Yeah.
That is the perfect way to end the show. All the best with the baby. Aww. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you both. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's been really fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I want to stay forever.
Yeah.
I loved that conversation with Rose and Rosie. They're just brilliant. They're a pair of absolute legends. If you haven't checked them out on YouTube, you have to. You must. And I can really highly recommend their podcast, Rose and Rosie Parental Guidance. They're an absolute pair of legends. I love them. And if you're looking for another recommendation of a podcast, I can highly recommend The Logbooks. Absolutely brilliant. It's about the logbooks that exist within the gay and lesbian switchboard. They go through different sort of times. So I think they start in the 70s and the 80s. Series 2 has started just before Christmas, I think. And the first 3 episodes are about the AIDS epidemic and how they sort of responded to it and reacted to it and helped people. And it's just brilliant. It's such a brilliant piece of history. And I've absolutely loved both series. So that comes highly, highly recommended from me. If you're looking for something new, if you want to get in touch with me, please do. You always can. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. I'm also on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. Get in touch if you like. Thanks again to all of you that have got in touch. Please rate and review the podcast if you have time. And I will chat to you next week, where I have a brilliant guest for next week. I'm very excited to share them with you. And I'll speak to you then. You take care. Bye-bye.